My guest this morning is Maria Hernandez Segoviano, who is the Advocacy Coordinator for Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. Thank you so much for talking with me this morning, Maria.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the upcoming September 8th Day of Action that's sponsored by the Just Transition Alliance, and that Day of Action is called Rise Up for Climate Jobs and Justice. And so you're making a lot of connections between Measure 105 and climate justice that might be surprising to some of our listeners, right? Some connections that we haven't really thought through. But let's start talking, let's start out talking about the September 8th event. Can you tell us more about it?
Absolutely. The September 8th event is in linked in solidarity with the National Day of Action happening not only within the United States, but also internationally, where folks are coming together and really gathering to call upon our leaders and or decision makers to really listen to frontline communities' decisions and visions and goals really for a climate justice framework, for economic justice, and really also for justice that includes immigrant rights, includes energy justice, and includes all the other aspects that really deal with our context right now. And so the event is going to be super wonderful. I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be September 8th, as you mentioned, from 12 to 4 at Glen Haven Park. And we really look forward to draw upon these links, particularly with issues relating to fossil fuel industry and really saying no to fossil fuel industry, calling also upon issues out here locally, but also extend globally, such as Measure 105, which is a measure that is an anti-immigrant policy, really, that if it moves forward can do a lot of harm to our communities, and also uplifting solutions that really link, right, how our frontline leadership must be listened to, such as solutions that are being carried for energy justice, like the Portland Clean Energy Fund.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about 105 specifically, because some of our listeners may not be familiar with the specifics. So can you tell us a little bit about the provisions within Measure 105 and what its likely impact would be if passed?
Absolutely. So Measure 105, formerly known as IP22, it's an attempt by an anti-immigrant group called Oregonians for Immigration Reform to repeal or estate 30-year-old inclusivity law. And I say that again, 30 years old, because this is really important. The 1987 inclusivity law really prohibits the use of state and local resources to enforce federal immigration law. It's huge because currently this law has a strong support by state and local law enforcement and contributes to the health and safety of our communities. And this is going to be in question on November and the November ballot. And it's really important to say no to this type of measures, because if this law is eliminated, we could see a huge increase in racial profiling, separation of families, children based on perceived immigration status, and distrust of law enforcement in our communities. Additionally, law enforcement resources can be directed away from local and federal law enforcement to contribute to this immigration enforcement machine that we currently have. So Measure 105 will repeal this 30-year inclusivity law, which then will lead for an increase over resources to potentially come back in the way of racial of profiling to our communities. And it's important to say no, as I mentioned, because our communities right now are the crossroads. They're impacted by not just immigration, anti-immigration policies. They also are impacted by our climate change. They're impacted by economic exploitation, and most certainly are impacted by the environmental injustice and racism that exists within our state.
So this would basically dismantle the Oregon sanctuary state status.
This measure could definitely open doors not only for more police in schools and check on our students, but also can open the doors to be in spaces in which our communities currently feel safe. Opal works with Bus Riders Unite, groups who are dependent upon the transit system to go about their days. And our communities, the moment they'll see someone with a gun, the moment they'll see someone in police uniform, that increases a sense of fear. And for this to be increased even farther, it can be a possibility for a community not feeling like they can go about their day-to-day life like any regular person. And so as a whole, like, this does open opportunity for more racial profiling anywhere you go, at your job. Like, we saw it also and the current ice raids that happen in Woodburn. And so therefore, this measure, it's super important that we say no and we come as a community to really demand that this is not acceptable, and that if we believe in inclusivity and if we believe in sanctuary laws, then we must demand for such of these policies to not move forward.
Yeah, I'm thinking also of the work that Opal's done around the militarization of TriMet, and the fact that if 105 passed, ICE could collaborate with the transit police to stop people and check their immigration status as they're leaving TriMet. So just the commute to work could turn into a kind of immigration sweep. So tell us a little bit more about the connections that you're making between 105 and the fossil fuel fight in the Pacific Northwest and around climate change more broadly.
The struggles for immigration justice, it's really also a climate justice issue, and they are very much inextricably linked. Our communities have been asking no on the LNG pipeline that's happening in rural Oregon, particularly with the terminals in Malin and Coots Bay. They're saying no to this over 200-mile pipeline because
The Pacific Connector Pipeline.
Yes, thank you. Because, you know, that in itself harms our communities in many ways, not just on the temporary, but also for the long term. You can see how if that pipeline were to come into place, it will run through sacred areas, places where our indigenous folks have been living. And as someone who dearly believes in the aspect that or indigenous folks know best, they were the ones here in this land, they know how to work it, they know what we need, because they've been doing it for so long. We should be learning from them, and we should continue to carry their legacy, really, as owners and true knowledge seekers and owners, really, of this land. Pipelines, not just here locally in Oregon, but also pipelines across the global state, opens up like this opportunity to look at how those efforts happening and in anti-immigration policies coming in are continuing to harm the same communities, frontline communities. And when I say frontline communities, I refer to not just folks who are at the front of one issue, but folks who have historically been on the front line. So people of color, low income, rural communities, youth, seniors, folks with disabilities, folks who continue to be left behind on any issue, not just fossil fuel-driven policies, but also on issues of transportation injustice, housing injustice. I mean, our folks continue to be the ones being displaced, not having access to transportation, not having access to the services that they would need, healthcare, job security, you know, schools. So all of it is linked, and that's what we're trying to emphasize to folks. This is not a siloed issue. We must look at it all together.
So we're talking about both kind of local impacts and risks in terms of things like oil spills and the damage to salmon spawning grounds that are essential to preserve treaty-protected fishing rights of indigenous communities. But we're also talking about some of the downstream effects of climate change. So I know we were talking a little bit about pesticide exposure of farm workers in the fields, but also, you know, we're seeing kind of record forest fires around the region right now, and people are being encouraged to stay indoors. Well, what does that mean for farm workers and other people who may be disproportionately people of color who are working in laboring jobs where they can't be inside? So not only are they getting this dose of pesticides in the fields, now they're getting their lungs filled with, you know, the burning forests, which are an effect of climate change.
Yeah, and I will say this loud too. We recognize that there is a climate crisis, and we too are living in an economic crisis. And, you know, where our corporations and the 1% continues to uphold what they pretty much won and continue to leave our 99% behind. And we too recognize that we live in a place right now, and we see it with Measure 105 and with the issues happening where it's decisions being carried not by our communities and by our communities one, but what typically comes at the top, right? So to your point around like the interlinks of like the pesticides, yeah, I mean, in 2017 alone, in Northern California, actually, and in Oregon, with the wildfires that happened, more than like 100,000 people had to be displaced from their homes. Right now in Portland, folks are being displaced as well from their homes because they can't simply afford to pay the high increase, spiking rent increases, or the no-cost evictions I continue to get, right?
How are insurance companies going to be passing along the increased costs of insurance claims for wildfire burns and for flooding and all these other kinds of climate disaster-related damages? Renters are going to start to carry some of those costs of rising insurance.
When we talk about climate change and immigration rights, climate change and fossil fuel industry and how that is all linked, we can talk about finding solutions for climate change, but we must start talking about finding solutions that bring in climate perspective or environmental perspective, bring our economic perspective, and most certainly, and as a must, bring our justice perspective lens into the forefront, because we're at a point right now which we can talk about all these issues. We can talk about, you know, Puerto Rico and how hundreds of families have also been displaced and continue to live with no energy efficiency and no energy at all, and how that is linked to our ground right now, because the same communities who are at the forefront are continuously being the ones being displaced, being targeted. Even so, when they're like the lowest contributors to our emissions, to our climate change. And I say that as a Mexican individual who has family in the global South, but more particularly in South Mexico, like thinking through, like, you know, our communities there, they're harvesting, they're doing, their migration is being impacted by the United States imperialism. Imperialism carries across borders. And when we see that, well, we need to ask the question, why is it that our folks are immigrating? Well, it's because of that devastation of our climate change. So when they come here, right, and look for avenues to a better life and do all of those things, we need to start recognizing that we need solutions that look at the links on a global perspective, because there's no solution that does not include these communities first. There's no real solution that excludes our communities, our environmental justice communities. Those may be bridge solutions, but they're certainly not real solutions because we're not seeing them on the ground for the benefit of our folks.
So you're really making the connections between climate refugees, climate migration from the global South, from Mexico, from Central America, you know, obviously, which is also hugely impacted by U.S. imperialist violence and militarism. You're really talking about the ways in which climate migration and the U.S.'s disproportionate role in producing carbon emissions is driving this migration, and then those folks, as they're trying to come in across the border, are really being criminalized. Can you tell us more about the day's events on September 8th?
Of course, we're joining in solidarity at a national perspective and an international perspective because, again, no solution is a real solution if it doesn't include the communities who are most impacted first and worst by climate change, economic exploitation, and really the crises of environmental injustice. And so we're inviting folks to come and join us and really follow frontline leadership in regards to the solutions. So we want to invite folks to, again, join us on September 8th from 12 to 4 at Glen Haven Park next to the Madison High School on 82nd Avenue, and really join us and call for frontline leadership decision-making to lead about a real transition, a just transition from our current economy to one that is works for all of us. So I welcome everyone to join us and really stand in solidarity as well with us and support our communities.
And that's an event sponsored by the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, and it's part of a national day of action. So again, that's September 8th in Glen Haven Park, beginning at noon. My guest today has been Maria Hernandez Segoviano from Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. Maria, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find more information about the September 8th day of action at the website for the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, orjta.org. This has been Desiree Helligers for the Omaha Variety Hour.
See, before I draw the line, let me welcome you close to all the folks who knew Obama sold the people a hoax, gave the money to suckers while our community's still poor, withdrew the troops but started another war, colonizing, terrorizing, creating the oil crisis so they can make